Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Ezekiel chapter 28, which I will entitle Prophecy Against the Prince of Tyre and Sidon. Precept Austin, my source of Ezekiel's timeline, says the prophecy was given in 586, but they're using that one-year earlier dating system, so we'll say it's 585, which is the year after Babylon destroyed Jerusalem and burned it to the ground. So we begin now in Ezekiel 28, verses 1 through 3. The word of the Lord came to me, Son of man, say to the ruler of Tyre, this is what the sovereign Lord says. In the pride of your heart you say, I am a god. I sit on the throne of a god in the heart of the seas. But you are a man and not a god, though you think you are as wise as a god. Are you wiser than Daniel? Is no secret hidden from you? Now in verse 2, God calls Ezekiel son of man, as he does in just about every chapter. And as I've said in just about every audio concerning Ezekiel, there are two theories as to why God calls Ezekiel son of man. One is he's trying to show that Ezekiel has the characteristics of a man, namely fallibility, weakness. So don't be making yourself proud, Ezekiel, just because you're having all these visions from God. Option number two is that God actually made Ezekiel a type of the antitype Jesus, because Jesus always referred to himself as the Son of Man. He did it all the way through the Gospels. He took the phrase from Daniel 7:14, when the Son of Man ascended into the Ancient of Days, a messianic term the Old Testament writers and readers would know that that Son of Man was the Messiah. And so Jesus calls himself the Son of Man to prove that he's the Messiah. Now, how is Ezekiel a type of Jesus? Well, Ezekiel was preaching against the rebellious house of Israel, and he was speaking about their destroyed temple in 586 and destroyed capital city, Jerusalem, in 586. And Jesus was doing the same thing, except when he prophesied against Israel and the temple and Jerusalem from the top of Mount Olives in the Olivet Discourse, he was referring to the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70 by the Romans. Now, the Sovereign Lord says, and of course that title of the Lord is also used all the way through Ezekiel, God is sovereign. He is in control of history, and a lot of what Ezekiel is talking about was history. So the Sovereign Lord says, in the pride of your heart, talking to the Prince of Tyre, the ruler of Tyre, the pride of your heart. Well, who is the ruler of Tyre? His name is Ethbaal the Third, or Ethbaal the Third, I guess I should say. Josephus calls him Ethbaalus. He reigned from 591 or 590 to 573 or 572, depending on your dating system. And you will notice that 586 to 573 is the time period in which Nebuchadnezzar besieged Tyre, finally overthrowing Tyre, or not really overthrowing it, but getting Tyre to submit to Babylon without destroying the city, in 573. Also notice that this Prince of Tyre has a name which implies his close connection with Baal, the famous Phoenician god, the supreme Phoenician god. Baal is in his name, Ethbaal the Third. So Ethbaal was the representative of Baal. Now we're going to see that many of the commentators think that Ethbaal is a type of the Antichrist, and I'm going to ask the question as we go through, where's the evidence of that? I don't believe that at all. As a matter of fact, there is no the Antichrist in the New Testament. There's a sea beast, and there's a man of sin, and there are Antichrists at the time of the early apostles like John, Antichrist, but there's no capital T, capital A future Antichrist, unless you want to make some assumptions that the sea beast is the future Antichrist, and I don't hold that assumption. Likewise with the man of sin, you have to make an assumption there, but I don't hold that assumption. It might be true that these two figures in the New Testament are the Antichrist, but there's no proof of it. It's speculation, and it's really speculative to say that the ruler of Tyre is a type of the Antichrist, a type of someone who you can't even prove exists. Now, the Cambridge commentary says that the Prince of Tyre is not an individual ruler, not Ethbaal the Third, but rather the kingship of Tyre, the office of kingship. I don't think so. We're going to take the ruler of Tyre as an individual named Ethbaal. Now, God says to Ethbaal, in the pride of your heart, you say, I am a god. This is where people get the idea that this is a type of the Antichrist. I am a god, but I might point out that there are millions of ancient kings who thought they were gods. I am a god. I sit on the throne of a god in the heart of the seas. The Heart of the Seas could refer to New Tyre, which is an island off the coast of Lebanon, off the coast of Phoenicia, off the coast of Tyre. Old Tyre was on the coast, New Tyre was in the sea. Could refer to that, but not necessarily. You could just refer to the fact that Tyre is a seagoing nation that's surrounded by trade coming from all the seas of the world. So God continues speaking to Ethbaal, but you are a man and not a god. Though you think you're as wise as a god, are you wiser than Daniel? Now that's, I'm pretty sure, is the Daniel who wrote the book of Daniel in our canon. However, the NIV footnote says that the word is Daniel, not Daniel. The Hebrew spelling may suggest a person other than the prophet Daniel. Well, I don't believe that. Are you wiser than Daniel? Daniel was famous for his wisdom. Daniel is now at the court of Babylon, as a matter of fact, and Ezekiel is in Babylon too. And Daniel was famous throughout all Babylonia for his knowledge in politics, his wisdom and prudence in government, and his skill in interpreting dreams, as we will see when we get to the book of Daniel. Daniel's fame, in fact, may have reached all the way to the king of Tyre, and that's why God feels comfortable in mentioning Daniel to the king of Tyre, figuring that Tyre would know about Daniel. We go now to Ezekiel 28, verses 4 through 10. Yahweh continues to speak to Ethbaal. By your wisdom and understanding, you have gained wealth for yourself and amassed gold and silver in your treasury. Now, in our last chapter, chapter 27, we saw that Tyre was conducting commerce all over the world, all the way from Persia to Spain to Libya to Armenia to present-day Georgia, Cappadocia, everywhere. And so that's what God's referring to here. You have amassed gold and silver in your treasuries. Verse 5, Ezekiel 28. By your great skill in trading, you have increased your wealth, and because of your wealth, your heart has grown proud. That's typical. There's not very many humble rich people that I know of. I could mention a few contemporary names, but I won't. Verse 6, therefore this is what the Sovereign Lord says, because you think you are wise as a god, I am going to bring foreigners against you, the most ruthless of nations. That would be the Babylonians, the most ruthless of nations. That could refer to the fact that the Babylonian Empire had many constituent nations in it, because it was an empire. That term is relatively loose. They will draw their swords against your beauty and wisdom and pierce your shining splendor. Verse 8, Ezekiel 28. They will bring you down to the pit. Now, the pit is usually the grave. Some people suggest the bottom of the sea. Remember in our last chapter, chapter 27, God made an extended metaphor concerning Tyre, saying Tyre was like a big ship getting ready to be sunk. Well, I think it's just as easy to say, or easier to say, that bringing down to the pit means they're going to die. Not they. The Tyrians are going to die, but you, Ethbaal, are going to die. You're going to be brought down to the grave, and you will die a violent death in the heart of the seas. The heart of the seas, again, is Tyre. Now, let's look at some options as to how we should interpret that metaphor. Option number one, God is still comparing Tyre to a ship, and the ship is going to sink in the heart of the seas. Option number two, Tyre, both old and new Tyre, are centrally located in world trade, which was on the sea, so they're in the heart of the seas. Or it could be referring to the fact that Alexander destroyed new Tyre in 332 BC, in the heart of the seas. Well, the problem with that, Alexander doesn't have anything to do with Ethbaal, and we're taking this as being Ethbaal. And none of my commentators say that Alexander the Great's destruction of Tyre in 332 BC is being referred to here. It's the Babylonians. 586 to 573 under Nebuchadnezzar. That's who is attacking Tyre. And again, this is a prophecy by Ezekiel because the siege is not finished yet. It finishes in 573, and we said this prophecy was being given in 585. So, verse 8, Ethbaal has been taken down to the pit in the heart of the seas. Verse 9, will you then say, I am a god in the presence of those who kill you? Gods don't get killed, but Ethbaal, you're going to get killed. You will be but a man, not a god, in the hands of those who slay you, because gods aren't killed, but men are. Verse 10, you will die the death of the uncircumcised at the hands of foreigners. Now the KJV has deaths, apparently the Hebrew does too. You will die the deaths of the uncircumcised. That's a little bit strange. Most of the modern translations just have death. Adam Clark says it refers to two deaths, both temporal death and eternal death. I think that's a stretch. I think it's just a artifact of the language. Now, I'm going to assume here that Ithabal III was taken and killed by Nebuchadnezzar in 573. His death date is given by Wikipedia. Ithabal's is at 573, and we know that's also the date that the siege ended, so that's more than a coincidence to me. Let me read to you from Wikipedia in the article Siege of Tyre, 586 to 573. Nebuchadnezzar II was never able to take control of Tyre by military means, leaving the result of the siege as militarily inconclusive. The king of Tyre, Ithabal III, either died near the end of the siege or was replaced as part of the surrender. He was succeeded by Baal II, who ruled as a vassal to Babylon. Well, nobody knows exactly how Ithabal III went down, apparently. He either died or was replaced. Wikipedia doesn't seem to be as sure as Ezekiel was that Ithabal was going to be killed by Nebuchadnezzar, and I'm going to assume that Ezekiel is correct, even though we don't have historical evidence of the fulfillment of that, at least not that I know of. Now, in verse 10, God tells Ithabal that you will die the death of the uncircumcised. What does that mean, the death of the uncircumcised? Well, here are two options from Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. Option number one, this refers to a death that the uncircumcised or godless heathen deserve. The pulpit commentary backs that up and says, as the uncircumcised were to the Israelite, so should the king of Tyre, unhonored, unwept, with no outward marks of reverence, so should he die. In other words, the Jews thought it was dishonorable to be uncircumcised, and so, likewise, it would be a dishonorable death that the king of Tyre would die. The other option from Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown is that the death of the uncircumcised refers to such deaths as the uncircumcised inflict on others. In other words, it was a great ignominy in the eyes of a Jew to be killed by an uncircumcised individual. Well, whatever it was a fit retribution on Ithabal, who had scoffed at the circumcised Jews. Remember, Tyre had mocked Jerusalem when Jerusalem got wiped out by the Babylonians in 586. We go now to Ezekiel 28, verses 11 through 14. The word of the Lord came to Ezekiel. Now this is God speaking in verse 12. Son of man, take up a lament concerning the king of Tyre and say to him, this is what the sovereign Lord says. You are the model, now this is talking about Ithabal, the prince of Tyre. You are the model of perfection, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. You were in Eden. Now notice that. You were in Eden, the garden of God. Every precious stone adorned you. Ruby, topaz, and emerald, chrysolite, onyx, and jasper, sapphire, turquoise, and beryl. Your settings and mountings were made of gold. On the day you were created, they were prepared. You were anointed as a guardian cherub, for so I ordained you. You were on the holy mount of God. You walked among the fiery stones. Now again, we see the prince of Tyre as being the model of perfection, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. That's why people say, oh, it's the Antichrist. You were in Eden. Now, this is a metaphor. Tyre was as beautiful as the Garden of Eden. Tyre was a paradise which Ithabal squandered, just like Adam squandered his paradise. And so I think that's all that's being referred to here. Now, you will notice as we go through that there are many, many characteristics of Eden that are mentioned here. I'll point them out in a minute. But first, let's note in verse 13 that the prince of Tyre, Ithabal, was adorned by every precious stone. Let's see what Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown has to say about that. So the king of Tyre was arrayed in jewel-bespangled robes after the fashion of Oriental monarchs. The nine precious stones here mentioned answer to nine of the 12, representing the 12 tribes, in the high priest breastplate. Of the four rows of three in each, the third is omitted in the Hebrew, omitted here in our verse in Ezekiel 28, but is supplied in the Septuagint. I imagine some translators noticed the three were missing and got a little loose and said, well, let's just put them in there. In this, too, there is an ulterior reference to Antichrist. Here we go, the Antichrist, who is blasphemously to arrogate the office of our divine high priest. And how does Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown know there is an ulterior reference to the Antichrist? That's a leap which I refuse to take. Now, all these stones, I'm not going to go into them because I've discovered when studying stones that to get from the Hebrew to the modern English is to go through a lot of jumps, and nobody knows exactly what color this stone is or what stone is being referred to, so I just lump them all together and say they were sparkly, shiny, and beautiful. God continues talking about the Prince of Tyre in verse 13, Ezekiel 28. He says, your settings and mountings were made of gold. It's not the stones, but the stones were put into gold settings. On the day you were created, they were prepared. Now, what was the day that the king of Tyre was created? Two options. It could be on the day he was born, or more probably, it refers to when Ethbaal was made king. Because when you're made king, you're going to have robes with all the precious stones and gold. When you're a little baby being born, not so likely. Now in verse 14, God says that Ethbaal, the prince of Tyre, was anointed as a guardian cherub. This is a reference to the fact that Eden had guardian cherubs too, and Tyre is being compared to the Garden of Eden. For so I ordained you. Now Adam Clark says the cherubim here are being referred to as the cherubim who guarded the gate to the Garden of Eden. But the other option, which John Gill takes, is the cherubim who are being alluded to here are the cherubim in the Holy of Holies over the mercy seat. As Gill says, in allusion to the cherubim over the mercy seat, which covered it with their wings, and which, as the Ark of the Testimony and all the vessels of the tabernacle were anointed, were so likewise. In all probability, the king of Tyre is called a cherub because of his wisdom and power, anointed because of his royal dignity, and he covers, the one that covers, because of his office, which was to protect his people. I don't know where Gill says that Ethbaal covers anything. Well, I just looked it up in the King James. The King James has, thou art the anointed cherub that covereth. Translation issue is not in the NIV. I prefer the interpretation that says that Yahweh is referring to the cherubim in the Garden of Eden, because verse 13, Eden was specifically mentioned. Now, at the end of verse 14, God tells Ethbaal, you were on the holy mount of God. Oh, the holy mountain. You walked among the fiery stones. Where is this holy mountain? Now, I'm going to give you three options. Option number one is from John Gill. The holy mountain, wherever it is typical of the Antichrist, because the king of Tyre was never on Mount Zion or Mount Sinai. Well, John Gill is famous for taking an historical reference and shrinking it down to nothing and making it completely antitype. And plus, I don't believe that this chapter has anything to do with the future so-called Antichrist. So I'm going to knock that option out, and that leaves us mainly with two options. One is Mount Sinai. In other words, as Jameson Fawcett and Brown says, God is being sarcastic here. You were on the holy mount of God. You were like Moses on Mount Sinai. You had it made. Here's what Ellicott says. The prophet still has his mind upon Mount Zion, but yet the words are ironically spoken of Tyre as a venerated sanctuary rising up from the sea. I find this hard to believe, that the holy mount is referring to Mount Zion. First of all, you walked among the fiery stones. What fiery stones would that be? Well, you could say this is all a metaphor pointing to the dazzling nine stones that were sewed into Ethbaal's kingly robes. I guess we could handle it that way. But I still don't think that the holy mount of God is Mount Zion. I think option number three, or really option number two, is the Garden of Eden. Let me give you four reasons why. Well, first of all, Eden is explicitly mentioned in Ezekiel 28:13. Let me read that again for you. You were in Eden. Well, there it is. But you might say, but wait a minute, holy mountain. How is Eden a mountain? Well, Eden was on a mountain. We can prove that by pointing out that a single river flowed out of Eden and then divided into four rivers. Now, if a river is flowing out from a place, that place has to be higher than the place to which the river is flowing. So we read in Genesis 2:10 through 11 and 13 and 14, a river went out from Eden to water the garden. From there it divided and became the source of four rivers. The name of the first is Pishon, which flows through the entire land of Havilah, where there is gold. The name of the second river is Gihon, which flows through the entire land of Cush. The name of the third river is the Tigris, which runs east of Assyria, and the fourth river is the Euphrates. So, in order to flow out of Eden, Eden had to be high. As Crossway.org, in an article called What is God's Holy Mountain, says, this idea of Eden being on a mountain is well known amongst Old Testament scholars. I took a course in biblical theology, and I heard about Eden being on a mountain over and over and over again, so I don't have any doubt about that. So, the Holy Mount, I submit to you, is the Garden of Eden. Well, that's the second reason that this reference in Ezekiel 28 is to the Garden of Eden. Plus, first, because it was explicitly mentioned to be Eden in verse 13. Second is because the Garden of Eden was on a mountain, and also cherubim are mentioned. Cherubim is plural for cherubs. Genesis 3:24. He, that's God, drove man out, drove Adam out, and stationed the cherubim and the flaming whirling sword east of the Garden of Eden to guard the way to the tree of life. So the Garden of Eden was guarded by a cherubim. And God, in verse 14, says, you were anointed as a guardian cherub. And then Ethbaal in Ezekiel 28:14 is said to have walked among the fiery stones. Well, Eden had precious stones. Genesis 2:10-12, a river went out from Eden to water the garden. From there it divided. It became the source of four rivers. The name of the first is Pishon, which flows through the entire land of Havilah, where there is gold. Gold from the land is pure. Bdellium and onyx are also there. And I assume that the other precious stones are there too. Bdellium and onyx and gold are specifically mentioned. Well, I think the allusions are close enough to say that Ethbaal, Tyre was Eden for you, and you blew it, just like Adam blew it. And you're going to die, just like Adam died. Now, I said the fiery stones could be the stones on the ground of the Garden of Eden, and I think that's what it is, but there are some other options. Gill says the fiery stones were precious stones with which the king of Tyre was adorned, which glittered like fire, the stones that were sewed into his royal garments. Option number two is from Clark. He says that Ethbaal was walking on precious stones on the floor of his palace, those precious stones shining and sparkling like fire. Jameson Fawcett and Brown has option number three, which I think is a stretch. He says that this is a reference to Yahweh's pavement of sapphire. Well, why would Ethbaal be walking on God's pavement of sapphire? Jameson Fawcett and Brown says the answer to that is, in ambitious imagination, he stood in the place of God, under whose feet was, as it were, a pavement of sapphire, while his glory was like devouring fire. I don't think so. I think Jameson Fawcett and Brown are off base there. Best solution, in my opinion, is the stones on the ground of the Garden of Eden. We go now to Ezekiel 28, verses 15 through 17. God continues to speak to the prince of Tyre. You were blameless in your ways from the day you were created till wickedness was found in you. Through your widespread trade, you were filled with violence and you sinned. So I drove you in disgrace from the Mount of God, and I expelled you. Again, there's that idea of being driven from disgrace from the Mount of God, the Garden of Eden. And I expelled you. Now, of course, Ethbaal was not in the Garden of Eden. This is just a metaphor to describe Tyre, where Ethbaal lived. And I expelled you, O guardian cherub, from among the fiery stones. Your heart became proud on account of your beauty, and you corrupted your wisdom because of your splendor. So I threw you to the earth. I made a spectacle of you before kings. Now in verse 15, God says that the prince of Tyre was blameless when he was created. As John Gill says, from the time that Tyre became a kingdom, or this king was set over it, everything was wisely conducted and all things happily succeeded. But then in verse 16, through your widespread trade, you were filled with violence. Now, there's nothing wrong with trade. There's a lot of people who think that business is inherently evil. There are a lot of people who think that being a businessman is akin to being the Antichrist. I remember one time I'm teaching business in my college. A professor walked up, saw me writing on the board, and said, what are you teaching, Dan? And I said, business ethics. And he looked at me and he said, isn't that somewhat oxymoronic? Business and ethics contradict each other. He was a sociologist. He would know. But there's nothing wrong with trade. It's just the dishonest trade and the pride that came from getting rich from the trade. That was what was evil. So then Tyre was filled with violence. That's violence, man. That's not just being greedy and skin flinty. That means killing people. You sin. So I drove you in disgrace from the Mount of God. As I mentioned, that's just like Adam was kicked out of his Eden. Ethbaal was kicked out of his Eden. And I expelled you, O guardian cherub, from among the fiery stones, the glittering stones that are littered at the bottom of the Garden of Eden. And verse 17 is self-explanatory. Ethbaal's proud. His wisdom became corrupted because he was so splendid. He was not wise anymore. He became as a fool. God threw him down to the earth. And all the other kings of the earth looked at him and said, ha, 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 you are a spectacle. Which, of course, is exactly what Ithbaal did when Jerusalem was burnt by the Babylonians. Ha, ha. Ho, ho, ho. Little schadenfreude there. But it's coming back on his head. We go down to Ezekiel 28, verses 18 through 19. Yahweh continues, by your many sins, speaking to the prince of Tyre, Ithbaal, by your many sins and dishonest trade, you have desecrated your sanctuaries. So I made a fire come out from you, and it consumed you, and I reduced you to ashes on the ground in the sight of all who were watching. All the nations who knew you are appalled at you. You have come to a horrible end and will be no more. Now notice this, by your many sins and dishonest trade, this unfortunate result occurred. Nothing wrong with trade. It's dishonest trade that is condemned. Notice the adjective there. Ithbaal, you have desecrated your sanctuaries. Four options as to what that means. Option number one, sanctuaries refers to the palaces of the king. Gill and Benson hold that view. Benson says, thy throne, palace, judgment seats are being referred to here. The Hebrew word generally rendered sanctuary sometimes signifies a palace. I think that's pretty reasonable. Ellicott says that sanctuaries refer to the pagan temples of Tyre. Well, then the next question is, well, how can Ithbaal desecrate a pagan sanctuary? A pagan sanctuary is desecrated by definition. How can it become more desecrated? Well, Ellicott says, Tyrians, like the Gentiles of whom St. Paul speaks in Romans 1, verse 21, did not act up to the religious light they had, and violating their own consciences and sense of right, defiled even such representation of the true religion as still remained in their idolatrous worship. Well, I think that's a big, big stretch. Option number three, Ithbaal has desecrated the holy mountain of God. Ellicott mentions this as an option. Of course, the holy mountain of God, as we've said, is Eden, most probably. Problem with that is, sanctuaries is plural. You have desecrated your sanctuaries. Eden would be a singular sanctuary. And, of course, that would be metaphorical. Eden, Tyre as being represented by Eden. And you've desecrated your garden, your Tyre. I don't think so. Matthew Poole gives us option number four. Ithbaal has desecrated his sanctuary because Ithbaal is a king who thought he was a god. So Ithbaal has his own sanctuary because gods have sanctuaries. And so Poole says that God is being sarcastic toward Ithbaal. Oh, you're a god, huh? Well, where's your sanctuary? It just got burnt down. It just got destroyed. Now, I must say that all of this is metaphorical because we know that Nebuchadnezzar did not destroy Tyre. He couldn't get to New Tyre. He tried to build a causeway like Alexander the Great did in later years, and he failed. But I think all of this is referring to the destruction of Ithbaal himself, the prince of Tyre, who went down somewhere at the end of that siege in 573. In verse 18, Yahweh says, I made a fire come out from you, and it consumed you, and it reduced you to ashes on the ground. It's referring to the king, not the city. In the sight of all who were watching, the city was not reduced to ashes on the ground. And notice how God is speaking to Ithbaal directly. Notice all the yours and the yous that we encounter in these verses. By your many sins, you have desecrated your sanctuaries. So we move now to Ezekiel 28, verses 20 through 24. The word of the Lord came to me, son of man, God is now speaking to Ezekiel, set your face against Sidon. So now we turn from Tyre to the mother city of Sidon, which is a little bit further up the coast from Tyre, the coast of Phoenicia on the Mediterranean Sea. Prophesy against her and say, this is what the sovereign Lord says, I am against you, O Sidon, and I will gain glory within you. They will know that I am the Lord when I inflict punishment on her and show myself holy within her. I will send a plague upon her and make blood flow in her streets. The slain will fall within her, with the sword against her on every side. Then they will know that I am the Lord. No longer will the people of Israel have malicious neighbors who are painful briars and sharp thorns. Then they will know that I am the sovereign Lord. Sidon was considered a neighbor of Israel because they were right up the coast, not very far. Now God says in verse 22, I'm against you and I will gain glory within you, Sidon. As John Gill says, not by the conversion of them, not by the conversion of the Sidonians, not by acts of religious worship truly performed by them, not by prayer, confession of sin, or thanksgiving to God, but God will get glory by his judgments executed in the midst of the Sidonians. Just as a military commander gets glory when he wins a battle, likewise God's going to get glory when he wipes out Sidon. They will know that I am the Lord when I inflict punishment on her and show myself holy within her. I will send a plague upon her and make blood flow in her streets. Now, when was this punishment inflicted on Sidon? Lots of options here. Gill and Clark say it was when Babylon came, same time that Tyre went down. Gill says it could be Persia, which happened later. Persia conquered Babylon in 539. I got an article from Livius, the famous ancient history website, that says this: the Babylonian Empire was taken over by the Achaemenid Persians in 539 BC when Cyrus the Great captured Babylon. The Persians quickly took over the western provinces of the Babylonian Empire. The Phoenician towns surrendered voluntarily, and Sidon remained the administrative center. Well, that's a surrender. That's not exactly being destroyed. Alexander the Great conquered Sidon in 333 BC. Wikipedia mentions that there were many different conquerors of Sidon. In the years before Christianity, Sidon had many conquerors: Assyrians, Babylonians, Egyptians, Persians, Greeks, and finally Romans. Of course, the Assyrians are earlier than our time frame here, but all the rest of them came later, and Sidon got wiped out. I don't know which particular destruction of Sidon or conquering of Sidon was mentioned, but I'm sure that one of those or all of them fulfilled what Ezekiel was saying here in chapter 28, verses 20 through 24. Now we move to Ezekiel 28, verses 25 and 26, and we will be finished with this chapter. Yahweh continues, "This is what the Sovereign Lord says. When I gather the people of Israel from the nations where they have been scattered, I will show myself holy among them in the sight of the nations. Then they will live in their own land, which I gave to my servant Jacob. They will live there in safety and will build houses and plant vineyards. They will live in safety when I inflict punishment on all their neighbors who maligned them. Then they will know that I am the Lord their God." Well, as usual, the prophets who prophesy doom and gloom, they usually finish up with some good news. After judgment comes restoration. And of course, the purpose of all this is to show the pagan nations that, hey, even though I judged Israel in 586, Israel's not going to be finished. Jerusalem won't be finished. There's going to be a return from Babylon. When I gather the people of Israel from the nations would be the ancient Near East, the Babylonian Empire, where they've been scattered. The gathering would be, as Adam Clark says, the return of the Jews from captivity in Babylon. Clark says that, and of course that happened in 538 or 537 or so. I think the date is a little unclear, but what happened was in 539, the Persians beat the Babylonians, and then the Persians, under Cyrus the Great, gave a decree which allowed the Jews to go back and rebuild their temple and rebuild their city of Jerusalem. And that happened somewhere right after the destruction of Babylon or the defeat of Babylon in 539. Gill says that no, this return, this gathering of the people from the nations, is not referring to the return in 538 or 537, because the verse in verse 25, Ezekiel 28, says, "When I gather the people of Israel," and of course it was only the people of Judah that returned. Gill says, well, there might be some few of those scattered tribes that were scattered in 722 and who were referred to as Israel, the northern kingdom of Israel, not Judah. They might return, but God's not really talking about that. Well, I don't go for that. We've seen many times in the prophets that Israel sometimes refers to Judah. Sometimes it refers to the northern kingdom of Israel plus Judah. Sometimes it just refers to the northern kingdom. So I think Clark's right. This is referring to the return in 538/537. Now, there's another option. Jameson Fawcett Brown says that the people of Israel will be gathered because the people of Israel will convert surrounding heathen nations away from their idolatry and convert them to the worship of the one true God, Yahweh. Says Jameson Fawcett Brown, "Judaism, so far from being merged in heathenism, made inroads by conversions on the idolatry of surrounding nations." Well, I don't think that's what's being referred to here. Now, Mr. Futurist John Gill says this is referring to the destruction of the Antichrist, and after that, God's going to gather all true Israel to be saved. Well, Jameson Fawcett Brown allows that the 538/537 return from Babylon would be a type of such a gathering of all the people into the church. Those commentators say, quote, "Full accomplishment is yet future, when Israel, under Christ, shall be the center of Christendom, of which an earnest was given in the woman from the coast of Tyre and Sidon who sought the Savior." That's the Syrophoenician woman who was willing to eat the crumbs from the table as a Gentile dog, because Jesus said that I'm going first to the house of Israel. Well, all of that, again, is all speculation. But I'm willing to go with the fact that the return from Israel, as I've said so many times in previous audios, is a type of the gathering of people into the kingdom of God. Because Israel is the old Zion, the church is the new Zion. There are typological connections between the old and the new. I don't have a problem with that, but the primary reference here is to when the Jews came back. They're going to come back to Jerusalem. They're going to live there in safety. Nobody's going to get them. They're going to build houses. They were protected by the Persian Empire. They're going to plant vineyards. They're going to live in safety. And God's going to inflict punishment on all their neighbors who malign them. Malign, remember, Tyre, Sidon, Edom, Ammon. They made fun of Israel, Judah, when Jerusalem was burnt to the ground. Now, when God brings all the Jews back to, and when I say all the Jews, I mean a lot of the Jews, back to Jerusalem, back to Judah, then the surrounding nations, their neighbors, will know that Yahweh is God. Because only God could have done such a miraculous thing. It was miraculous. Ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished Ezekiel 28 on a happy note. And so now we're ready to go to Ezekiel 29 on our next audio, which I will call Prophecy Against Egypt. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.